Hi, Linda. Just gonna go fix the light behind me. Hopefully that helps a little. Hello, everybody. Good to see you. Hopefully you can see me with this light behind me. I am again at my in-law's house, so I'm not in my own space. I'll give everyone a moment to get settled. Okay. So welcome. It's good to see all of you. I'm excited for our call today. It's the first call in a couple of calls where we'll be looking at the Befriend Your Fear technique. One of my favorites. I'm so excited to introduce you to it and for us to really go deep into it. I'm excited for you all to practice with it as well. I think you're gonna really, really love it. So before we jump in, a couple of pieces. First of all, we've got our class this week and we've got our class next week, which will be part two of Befriend Your Fear. And then I think that is it for 2021. We'll have a couple of weeks off after that and we'll be back together live on January 11th. For a long call, for a longer workshop call on resistance archetypes. So we've got a lot of awesomeness coming our way, and also some break time. I hope all of you are gonna be doing something nice and relaxing during the time off. I wanted to remind you also, I saw some of you at Going Viral this morning. Thank you for being there. Thank you also, the chat goes so quickly for me. I didn't get a chance in the moment to say thank you for those of you that shared your experience with Sacred Depths. It just touches my heart and I appreciate you so much. What we're looking at there is a review of what we're looking at here. Don't feel, I'm always so grateful and happy when people sign up for previews. And also, don't, if you are short on time, don't feel like you have to be there. You're getting everything that you need here. It is a nice review if you want it. That being said, I did want to remind you that in January 13th, 14th, and 15th, I'm going to be doing the Art of Client Transformation Retreat again. And you all have a free ticket to that if you'd like to be there. It is, again, it is review. We go deep, as you know, in it. And I think there's a lot to get, even if you're in Sacred Depths, but just so you know that. But anyway, you'll get an opportunity to save your spot for that for free and to invite a friend if you want. That's January 13th, 14th, and 15th. The other piece that I wanted to make sure to mention today is, as all of you know, I am, even though I'm teaching, I'm also always in the process of learning and improving. I'm a lifelong learner and improver, and always looking for ways to go deeper, to bring more value, to hold tighter containers, etc. And one of my learning edges has actually been with Zoom. If you haven't already been able to tell from all this time, but you probably can, I don't really know, I'm not good with it. I still haven't figured out lighting, all the things. And one of the aspects of Zoom that is still really new to me is the chat. So it's been a year now, and I'm still learning the best uses for the chat, the not the best uses for the chat. I feel like with the pandemic, so many people in so many different fields and industries were just kind of thrown into this technology without best practices. And what I've been kind of starting to really see in groups that I facilitate and also in ones that I participate in is that there are some amazing uses for the chat, and then there are other ways that it can be distracting or overwhelming or not so great for the container. And so, because of that, I feel like it would be great for us to have put some protocols in place for our chat use. I'm sharing all of this for our container and also just to model for you that it's okay to be learning and in the process of learning as a facilitator and a teacher and a leader also, right? Like we are all perfectly imperfect or imperfectly perfect, however the saying goes. And I think what's most important is for us to be on top of it, right? And to just see where we can be going deeper. So I think the chat is a really important part of the container. And I think that there are ways that we can really tighten our container with the chat. And there are ways that it will help me also just hold the best possible space for you and for us to hold space for each other. So here is how I'd like for us to move forward with the chat. I think some of the ways that we're using the chat are really, really helpful and really support the container. So those ways are when we say hello to each other, welcome each other. Like Lauren put in the chat that she was having some trouble, so she's gonna hop off and hop on again. It's just nice for me to know if you kind of are hopping off, why, et cetera, if you have to leave early. So to say hello, goodbye, that kind of thing, I think is great. When I ask questions as we're looking at material and I ask you to answer in the chat, I think another great use of the chat, it allows for more people to share than if we were to go voice to voice, which then allows for more people to be expressed and for more people to learn from each other, to normalize experiences, as we're answering questions. So for sure, when I ask questions, a lot of times, the chat is used to highlight something that I'm sharing or teaching, or to share a resource that's related to something that we're looking at, or a resource that's related to something somebody else in the group has just shared. I think that's super helpful, and a great use of the chat, which doesn't always happen if you're in the room. There's just more space in the chat to share those resources, to put those links in. And I also think it's so beautiful and so helpful and so valuable. Anytime someone has shared and I see support happening for that person that has shared in the chat, validation, celebration, seeing them, etc. I feel like those are really the four places where how the chat is used best. And then kind of anything outside of that, not so much. The other thing that is important to mention, and I think I've mentioned this before, because of, I don't know, I call myself a dinosaur when it comes to technology, because I am a dinosaur when it comes to technology, and also because I'm so focused on you when I'm teaching, I don't always catch everything that happens in the chat. So, by us sticking to these four places, it will help me catch more. And also, that being said, if you share a question in the chat and you want me to answer it and I don't, it's not because I'm ignoring you. It really is just because the chat has gone by quicker than I can manage it. So please raise your hand, when we have space for Q&A and shares, and I'll answer then. All right, any questions on this or any other best practices that you've noticed that you feel would be helpful as we look at the chat? Simona.
Hello, everyone. There's a function in settings where you can actually create something that has a place to enter your questions. And so then there's a question, specifically a question area that folks can add questions to if that's something you'd want to do. So it's just going into the Zoom settings, adding so down below where we have chat, record, reactions, one of the things could be questions. And so if folks have a question, then it's siphoned off from the chat. And so you can look at it at the end and you can decide if it makes sense to bring it forward or to answer it in an email later.
Thank
That's
you for
all.
sharing that. I did not know that that was a function. And I will look into seeing how we can get instructions out for that. I know I would need instructions if I was going to go do that. So I'll
It
look
may be
into
too much for one person. A lot of times that's happened when there's a facilitator and then a facilitator support person online.
Yeah, I'll definitely thank you for sharing that, and I'll definitely look into it and see if I feel like it's something that can be helpful for us and that I can manage and that we can all manage. That's great. Yes, I will repeat the four ways. So to say hello or welcome, or you need to hop on or you need to hop off, please do that. We can use the chat to answer any questions that I ask. If I say, let me know in the chat, or just in general, as I'm, asking journaling questions, etc. To highlight anything that I'm sharing or highlight anything that anybody else is sharing voice to voice, to add a resource that's based on something that's being shared, I think it was a great use of the chat. And then to show support, validation, celebration, seeing anyone that it has shared. Any other thoughts? Or Libby's saying, what are some examples of how the chat doesn't help the container? So I think sometimes one example is like if there are some side conversations that happen or something not related to what we're talking about or sharing, it's just become so easy to use the chat for that. I think across the board, I've seen this in a lot of places. So something like that isn't so helpful. Rebecca.
Hi. I want to make a request as someone that struggles with the chat. Like, I find it really distracting. And my request is that, and I'm sorry, Simona, to put you on blast, but I just saw you taking notes and I really appreciate what you're doing. And there's a transcript of all of our calls that has everything that's already mentioned. And my request would be that if you want to go and look at something, like that you use that resource rather than the chat, because I like when someone's sharing, I want to stay present with them, and I find it quite distracting. And that's my stuff. And if that doesn't really feel like, anyway, I just want to bring that forward because it just happened to arise here, and it's something that is present for me.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And again, like, I'm learning along with everybody else because the chat is new, and I can totally see, I don't want to make anybody wrong. Like, it can be, I can totally see why it could, I would think it is helpful too, but it's so good to get your perspective that the highlighting of the notes isn't helpful. And I really appreciate it. And I think it's true, like, as technology-oriented people in this modern age, we've become accustomed. This is important, by the way, not just for our conversation, for our group, but I think in general for us and for our clients to recognize, like, we've become so accustomed, myself included, to have our focus divided and try to be paying attention to many things at once. And it's actually not so helpful. And I am constantly, even in my own personal life, looking for the ways to block out as many distractions as I can so that I can stay as focused. It's almost like meditation, right? Like meditation where, like, we want to stay focused on what's present. And so thank you for bringing that forward. And yes, like, let us use this container to also practice as much presence as we can and stay focused. Like I said, I am in the process of we're all learning together, truly. I think this is all so new. And thank you for being willing to kind of to look at this with me. Okay. So, all that being said, let's jump in to our curriculum for today. And there are a couple of things that I think are important to share before we start to look at the befriend your fear process itself. The first is this entire bigger unit that we're stepping into. We started last week. We looked at projections and triggers. And as we look at befriend your fear, as we look at resistance archetypes, rewiring negative thought patterns, we'll look at wheel of self-sabotage and others. They're each their own, each of them are their own process, if you will. They're each their own technique. And they all fit together in a way. So the way that they all fit together is not just because they're different techniques for supporting our clients through their resistances and their fears and their obstacles, but they also fit together because if we go back to this idea of the difference between a breakthrough and a transformation, right? That a breakthrough is a new awareness, a new piece of information that comes forward, a new feeling, whereas transformation is that process of applying the breakthrough persistently and consistently until there's real and long-lasting change, then what that means is that sometimes we might do a befriend your fear process with a client or with ourselves, but we're not done, right? And then in the next session, some of that those pieces may come back in. We might want to do a befriend your fear again, or a rewiring process, or a wheel of self-sabotage process, or look at resistance, etc. oftentimes the process of real change is a process. It's not a once and done. And, you know, I could get on my soapbox about the transformational industry and the things that make me angry. And one of the big ones is tricking people into thinking that we don't have to work in order to see results and change in our lives. Having potential clients and people think that it's a once and done, this transformation process. And that is BS. It's a once and done for some surface changes and a good breakthrough, again, right? But one of the biggest ways to go down quickly as a practitioner is to join the industry or join maybe a belief that your client is bringing to the container that change needs to happen quickly. And that change does always happen quickly. The moment that you come at your client's growth and transformation and results from that perspective is the moment that you've got a whole lot of new pressure on yourself to co-create something unrealistic. It's the moment where you're going to bring on a lot more self-judgment or judgment of your client for not changing quick enough or attaining the results quick enough. That doesn't mean that awesome forward movement can't happen right away. It absolutely can, but it doesn't always, right? Change is a process. And I think I've shared this with all of you before. I actually share this on my sales calls with prospects because there is so much disinformation in society and in the transformation industry about how results are created and the work that's required. I actually tell prospects, if you're looking for the practitioner that's going to fly you to the moon and back in a day, I am not that practitioner. Like, I'm not your gal. That's not what our container is going to look like. So again, a quantum leap can sometimes happen, but really the truth about quantum leaps is that if we like peek behind the veils, there's a whole series of work that has happened to get to what looks like on the outside a quantum leap. Like, let's just be honest, right? So again, so important for us to know that and normalize that as practitioners, and then to normalize that for our clients as well, so they don't feel like there's something wrong with them, right? For not doing the impossible that these BS marketing things out there are saying that they can and should be doing. And then again, to pull back what I was saying earlier. And so that's why, you know, we may start a process by looking at a resistance archetype. And then from there, do a befriend your fear. And then from there, look at beliefs or myth of perfection, right? So you have all of these tools at your disposal for that. The way that I think this is helpful to share, like the way that I have really seen real change happen is support a client to a breakthrough, to a new awareness, to a new understanding, to a new vision, to a new feeling, to a new energy, etc. Strategize to support the client to take the next baby steps based on it. The breakthrough will energetically usually carry them through some steps. But then at some point, like the energy of that original breakthrough is gonna maybe start to, it has a half-life, if you will. and of course, taking the baby steps helps the energetics too, but then you come back and you do some more of the inner work and get the next breakthrough and then strategize the next steps and you move that way. So taking all of this into consideration, let me ask you a couple of questions about this. First of all, what's your, this is kind of a funny question. I mean, you may or may not be able to answer it, but I think it's still good to think about the question. What's your natural rate of true change and transformation? What's your natural rate of true change and transformation? Yeah, I'm seeing some slows in the chat. Me too, by the way. Rana's saying it depends. Yeah. Kim is saying long winters and then a leap, then that leap. I love that. Jamie's saying steady. Nice. Lauren, if your move is an indication, pretty slow. So wherever you're at with that, I want to normalize it. One is not better than the other. What are some of the judgments that you have maybe brought to yourself or to your clients or to people, other people you know or in relationship with? Because of the rate, their rate of transformation, or your rate of transformation. Yeah, Jamie's saying reliable return to the old story for a while. All right, anything before we move on that wants to be shared voice to voice on this? Anything that you're seeing or that feels important? Rana?
Hey, Joanna. So this has me curious about questions and around capacity, pacing, titration, and because I see this a lot within the coaching industry, the law of attraction manifesting type teachings that sometimes, not always, are based on an energy of speed and fast momentum.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a couple of pieces here. So first of all, in some ways, this is a continuation of our strategizing module when we looked at natural rhythms, right? So everybody kind of has, and we have different natural rhythms at different times. The same, so we want to take that into consideration, you know, whatever it is for our clients when we're strategizing, but we also just want to have this perspective of change doesn't always happen or usually happen in an instant, right? When we're working with our clients. In terms of things like law of attraction, without sidetracking too much, I'll just say this for now. I think there's a lot of law of attraction that is beautiful and wonderful. And I think a lot of practitioners that are using law of attraction are using it in beautiful ways and in ways that are in integrity. That being said, one of the potential traps of law of attraction that we really need to be aware of is that it was created by people with a lot of privilege, white, heterosexual, cisgendered men, who have more opportunity in many cases to create results and change with speed than many other people. And so there's things are a little rigged with law of attraction. That doesn't mean that it can't be useful if there's a law of attraction practitioner here. It's just that we always want to be aware of filters and privilege, even within bodies of work. So there's more we can say on that, but hopefully that stirs some things for you, Rana, and is helpful. Thanks for bringing that forward. Okay. So, with that backdrop, let's start looking at the topic of, Nihal, go ahead.
All right, it took me a little minute to find the raise hand button. I wanted to add on to what you and Rana were talking about and hold something in the space. And if there's something problematic around it, poke holes in it. But the, and I don't want to go down this law of attraction tangent. That's not my intention. My intention is really to hold space for the capacity of different types of people in their momentum. As you were typing in, like as people were typing in the chat, their kinds of momentum, I really resonate with this particular kind of bamboo that like sits underground and makes roots for 3 years. And then it shoots 80 feet in like 2 days. Like I do that over and over, but for 3 years, I'm like, I swear guys, I'm productive, you know? And I think that people are different types of beings, and some people are roses and you can whack them back and they'll bloom and bloom, and some people are apple trees, and like I just think that we all have different ways. I'll just leave that there, but I wanted to make sure that that wasn't a problematic approach to think that some people have the capacity for like amazing abundance and I'm making fruit, I'm making flowers and they just keep coming, or that like I hunker down or I'm a lichen on a rock or whatever it is. I think we can all kind of choose our elementary.
100%. I love that you're bringing different plants into it. And what you're sharing, I think, is very much connected to what we were looking at in the in strategizing around natural rhythms. Like the way you described bamboo, I never knew that about bamboo. That's very much like a tipping, what I would call a tipping pointer, right? Like you work and you work, and then there's the tipping point and the results happen. So absolutely, I love the examples, and that's why we want to use our listening skills and our questioning skills and our creating awareness skills to see what rhythm our clients are at. And human beings can have more than one different rhythm too.
I just want to add on to this because I feel like I've given testimonials where I've been like that person for other programs that's gone to the moon and back in 2 days, but it's negating the 3 years, you know, it's not holding that in the space. And I think that that's so important to hold it all. Like some people, maybe they do sprint, but what does it take to prepare and what community and what shoulders are they standing on? I think it's important to hold that too. Thank you.
I just want to reflect back. I feel in your share, Nihal, that you are starting to more deeply own the beauty of your process through this. So thank you. Okay. So we're going to jump into the found today. We're going to look at foundations of understanding fear, understanding befriend your fear. And then in our next week's session, we'll look at the actual befriend your fear technique. But it's important first for us to kind of come into, like we always do, the human behavior and the foundational principles first, and then we'll get to the technique. So I developed the term and the concept befriending your fear many years ago after many encounters and experiences with my own fear and also my clients' fears. And this idea of being friends with fear, making friends with fear, is very different than most of what you'll see out there, whether it's the transformational industry or just culture in general, around how to relate to fear. And even just this basic piece is so important. So what we are not talking about when we talk about working with fear ourselves or with clients, we're not talking about conquering fears. We're not talking about slaying your fears. We're not talking about destroying your fears. And I'm even going to go so far as to say this, we're not even talking about letting go of your fears. We're talking about making friends with the fear. Totally different concept. It's so important to approach fears from this perspective of relationship and friendship. Because when you do otherwise, when you ignore fears or avoid fears or try to fight fears, they will just get bigger and stronger and fight back harder and become more of an obstacle. So some of you may have heard me share this before. I always like to share this when we look at fear, is the scene from Sesame Street that I saw when I was, I don't know how old, 4 or 5 or 6. I watched Sesame Street way longer than I probably should have. I love that show. That I just has always stuck with me. And it was a little cartoon with a story about the sun and the wind. And in that story, the sun and the wind see a man walking down the street, and the wind says to the sun, "Hey, sun, I bet you that I'm stronger than you are. I bet you I can get the jacket and the hat off of that man way quicker than you can." And the sun says, "Awesome, I'm game. Let's see." And the wind goes first. And the wind tries to get the hat and the coat off the man with force. And by blowing. And by, like, almost like hating on the hat and the jacket to get it off, to get it off, to push it off, to make it come off. And what happens, it's not that the hat and the jacket come off, the man clings more tightly, right? So the hat and the coat clings even more tightly to keep them on against this force, against this resistance to it. Eventually the wind gives up, and then it's the sun's turn. And the sun just shines. The sun loves on the man and the coat and the hat, and it just holds space, and it shines, and it shines, and it loves on it, until eventually, of his own agency and avail, the man decides to take off the coat and the hat. So I've always loved this story, and I think it's such a great illustration of the difference between slaying your fears, conquering your fears, or just pretending like they don't exist, versus making friends with them. So a big component of befriending your fear is to get really connected to the fear, to be with it, to see it, to hold space for it, to understand it, to see where it's coming from. When we can do that, then we can see it for what it really is and for what it wants. The only way I have seen to diminish fear or to be able to move forward when there's fear is to become friends with it. So, that being said, let's get into some of the details here. Number one, fear is normal. Fear is normal. It's common. It's normal. And I'm so sorry about that. Not in my own home today. So it's common, it's normal, and it is expected that fear of some sort, in one way or another, is gonna rear its head when you are about to step into something bigger or different for yourself. Fear can absolutely 100% be part of the process of up-leveling and expansion. There is nothing wrong with fear. If you experience fear when you start to go after something you want or think about going after something that you want, it doesn't mean that you can't have the thing that you want. It just means that you have some, you're normal, you are a human being, and you have some fear. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you. And it doesn't mean that you're not whole and complete. I'm making such a big deal out of this because in our society, and again, a lot in the transformational industry, we see this. Fear has been stigmatized and even pathologized in a way. Fear has been stigmatized and pathologized. And as practitioners, we want to break away from this kind of thinking and this kind of perspective. As practitioners, we want to see and approach fear is that it's totally normal and it's healthy. And really it's there to protect us in one way or another. So when I say it's there to protect us, what I mean is this. Oftentimes when fear comes up, sometimes when fear comes up, there is a real and actual threat, right? And we want to pay attention to it. Other times when fear comes up, there isn't a real actual threat right in front of us or that's happening. But at some point in our life, there was a real threat. And so we developed this fear as a mechanism to protect us, a survival mechanism, if you will. So if we look at fear in this way, the fear is actually something to be respected. It's kind of like a smoke detector, if you will. It's just that sometimes our smoke detectors are not as fine-tuned as they could be. Or I should actually say it the other way around. They're too fine-tuned. They're hypersensitive. And they can't tell the difference between real smoke from a dangerous fire versus smoke from just overcooking dinner. So part of our job as practitioners is to support our clients to respect that smoke detector, but to be able to better discern between the dangerous fire and the overcooked dinner. We don't need to fix fear. We shouldn't fix fear. Instead, we want to assess if it's helpful or unhelpful. And then make the proper adjustments and reorientations around it. All right, so let me pause here. I just kind of shared a lot. What are you seeing that's important for you? What feels important here? What's coming together for you so far? I'd love to hear some voices on this. Mindy.
Well, I'm going to state something very obvious, but I feel the need to say it. Listening to you talk about fear this way, it makes it seem not so scary. So.
Yay! It is obvious, but it's not also. And so I'm so glad you're saying it.
So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. It just kind of made it like, oh yeah, it's just one more thing.
Yes. And so, and to your point, I think, I'm just gonna pull it out even further. Sometimes the problem is the fear of the fear versus the fear itself, or what we make the fear mean becomes way more of a problem than the fear itself.
My anticipatory fear and anxiety are far worse than anything that actually usually happens.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. Good. So I'm glad that it's making the fear less scary. Good.
Thank you.
Libby.
Yeah, the brain gets neural wired to stay safe and familiar. Yeah. And so anything that isn't familiar to us is deemed unsafe. And so it's like that cartoon where change and comfort are across each other and they're saying one of us has to go. Yes. But I mean that's just the way the brain, it's a healthy brain function. And it's just so nice to know, okay, my brain is functioning healthy, of course.
Right. Like to be able to say that already takes some of the stigma away from it. And then we can separate and see more clearly what's going on. Yeah, 100%. And we're going to talk about comfort a bit more too, because that's a piece in this for sure. Thank you for bringing that forward. Amy Jo.
Hi.
What you just said reminded me of Green Eggs and Ham. So I just wanted to put that in there because that book is such a great reminder. I've actually used this in client sessions when someone's so afraid of trying something new. And I also wanted to say, I had a client many years ago who had this a situation, I guess, where she knew her fear really well, and she had actually given her fear a name. And her name was Nellie, and she spent a lot of time in her life trying to push Nellie in front of a bus or out of a window or doing these really violent things with her fear. And it was like this part of herself that she was trying to kill. And when I helped her to understand that, you know, what we're talking about today, it really changed the course of our work together. And even to this day, she still will write me once in a while and say, "Hey, me and Nellie are doing great." And so I just felt really like this major victory as the coach in the moment where I had the idea to teach her how to not push Nellie in front of the bus. Yes. It really changed a lot for her. So I'm so glad we're talking about this.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. It's such a beautiful illustration of what we're talking about and how it needs to start with us as the practitioner and how we view fear. Thank you. And yes, I love Green Eggs and Ham. I'm glad you're bringing that in too. Stacy Singh in the chat, helping our client feel good or feel better is not necessarily what will best serve a client. I'm so glad that you're adding that to the conversation. It's so true. And I probably, you have all heard me say this because I say this a lot when I'm coaching. Sometimes I'll say, you know, it's not that I want you to feel uncomfortable, but I'm happy that you are feeling discomfort right now because it means, right? And it's so beautiful and important and valuable for us as practitioners to not only normalize fear, but also to normalize discomfort. We'll get more into that in a bit. Yeah, Carlita's saying, I love this because people so often think fear means that they shouldn't do the thing or it won't work or they can't move forward. Yeah, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means that they're normal, right? They're having a very human, normal experience in the process of moving towards what they want. Yes, yeah, sitting with their fear and the discomfort to shift the relationship. Stacy.
Yeah. What would you say to a client who thinks that their reaction to the discomfort is a voice from their intuition, telling them not to do something?
Yeah, such a beautiful question. I'm going to put that question back on you. So how think about your creating awareness skills and your questioning skills.
I would activate the embodiment piece with the client. I would ask them where they feel the fear in their body. And then if they're not feeling it in their body, or if they're using a lot of logic, or if my sense is it's coming from their thoughts, I would go deeper into that to help unravel where did they first have that thought. Are there any metaphors or symbols that come up for them around that thought, and help them understand that it came from the past and it might not be something that's present oriented for them.
Beautifully done. I love it. Yes, 100%. Great question and great answer.
Okay. Thanks for modeling the turning it around. Helpful.
Great. Okay, so let's keep on moving forward. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. And probably you've already started thinking about these, but just to allow you to just give you some more space around it. So how have you approached your own fear historically? Have you seen it as a problem? Have you seen it as an opportunity? Have you seen it as normal? Have you made yourself wrong or bad? How have you approached fear? Well, I'll ask that first. How have you approached fear? Mindy's saying head on with single focused determination. Yeah, and it's exhausting. Tiffany's saying sometimes shut down, sometimes really gently and quietly. Yeah. Here's another question to think about. What have you been believing about fear? You, until this conversation today, whether you've been conscious of it or not until now, what are some beliefs that you've had about fear? Either your own fear or your client's fears or other people's fears. Stacey's saying, if I go slow enough, I won't feel any. That's really interesting, Stacey. Jamie's saying that it could be walked around. Yep. Amy Jo Fear is my greatest teacher. Carlita's saying, I've believed others should prioritize and actively address the fears that stop them from wanting or doing what I want them to want or do. Nice calling yourself out on that, Carlita, yeah. Alana's saying, my big fears hide in a feeling of exhaustion rather than declaring their name when they walk in. I'm glad that you can see that, Alana. And when we get to resistance archetypes, we'll look at that, you know, through that lens too, because sometimes exhaustion can sort of be a resistance place, that masquerading place for sure. Rebecca's saying that fear is resistance or an excuse for inaction. It's the best excuse for inaction, right? Would you include phobias as fear in the context of this conversation? That's a great question, Rana. I'm hesitating because I feel like I don't clinically, like I don't know or understand enough about phobias to understand, to answer that question. I feel like I can't answer it. But if it works for you to think of it in that way, I think it's worth the exploration.
Joanna, if I may, I'm specifically asking that and bringing it up because I've recently been in conversations, not just with clients, but with other people as well, as folks are literally starting to emerge from their home and back into interactions, whether in the workplace or socially and all the things, and that they're, is it agoraphobia where one is afraid to leave their house? Is that the one? Yeah. And so this is like in my awareness now with in conversations. That's why I'm asking in the context of this.
Yeah. As we look at the befriend your fear process. So again, like it's out of my scope as a coach to talk about phobias because I think there's an actual clinical definition of it that I don't know. And so
I don't either.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't want to speak out of term.
Sure.
But aside from the terms, like the fear of going out after this long time, it is possible in certain contexts to apply the befriend your fear process and what we're looking at for sure.
Okay, that's helpful. Yeah. Thanks. I was just curious. No.
Yeah. Okay. So let's keep on going and look at our next concept around fear to be aware of. There's always something to risk. There's always something to risk. When we create a big goal for ourselves, or when we step into a bigger or a new place for ourselves, there is always something at risk. Whenever we go after a dream, step into this different place, there is always a relationship or a held belief or a value or an object or an idea about yourself that is at risk. You can think of it like jumping off a cliff. So if you're at the edge of a cliff and you want to get to the other side, what's on the other side is something that you want, is your goal, your new place, etc. In order to get to the other side, you have to take the risk. You have to make the leap and take the risk in order to get to the other side. I bring this up because usually fear comes up when, whether we realize it or not, we're contemplating taking that leap and there is risk involved. Whether you're conscious of it or not, when you consider taking a leap, there is a part of you that recognizes that there is risk. So it's good for us to be aware of this as practitioners, because oftentimes when fear comes up for our clients, whether they realize it or not, there's a risk assessment that's going on inside of them. But maybe a risk assessment with that faulty smoke detector that isn't assessing correctly. And so part of the work that we can do with our clients is a more, aligned risk, doing a more aligned risk assessment. What's the actual risk of taking this action or stepping into this new place? Is that a risk worth taking? Right. So before we even get to befriend your fear, which is we'll look at somatic pieces and all that, just on the cognitive level, we could approach fear in this way. What's the actual risk that's coming up for you right now? And is this a risk worth taking? Can be super helpful to look at it in those terms. And so that leads us to our next important concept, which Libby has brought up, which is that in a certain way, as human beings, or we could call it our egos or whatever it is, but in a certain way, we like to be comfortable. And if you are comfortable, then that is in diametric opposition to taking a risk. If you like to be comfortable, that is in diametric opposition to taking a risk. So the part of yourself that wants to stay comfortable is always, without unchecked, if you will, is almost always going to feel like the risk isn't worth taking. That part of yourself that wants to stay comfortable does not want to take the risk. And what I have found is that oftentimes somewhere inside of us, we equate comfort, even when the thing isn't comfortable anymore and it's working against us and it's like putting us in pain, right? But it's still the known thing. So we think it's comfort. But what I've noticed for people is that oftentimes, without realizing it, we equate comfort with safety. We think that they're one and the same. But they're not. So again, all of these pieces are important from practitioners' point of view to be aware of. But I want to go even deeper with this for a moment. So first of all, when we equate comfort with safety, sometimes we sabotage what we really want in order to hold on to a safety that isn't even necessarily there because of the comfort. But here's the other piece, which we could wax philosophical on for many hours, but I'll just mention lightly for now. The thought that we can do something to remain safe and secure all the time is a lie that we tell ourselves. The thought that we can be safe and secure all the time is actually kind of anathema to the human experience and to the natural world. And I don't say that like in a downer way, like everything is disaster and you have to watch out. But what I'm saying, and again, this is, you don't take this as truth with a capital T, like check this out for yourself to see how it lands for you. Part of being alive is to know that our status is always changing. The seasons are always changing. Things are growing. Things are falling away. We don't always have what we did at once have, right? Anything can happen. at any moment. And when we don't embrace that, and when we don't accept that, when we don't accept that there is mystery, that there is never full guaranteed security, not about our health, not about our relationships, not about our homes, not about our bank accounts, that's when we take ourselves out of the beauty and risk of being alive, where anything can happen. And that is amazing and scary all at the same time. Okay, I know I'm waxing philosophical here, but I bring it into our conversation because I think as a culture, we have a little bit of an addiction to being safe and secure all the time. So I'll pause on that for a moment. Anything that wants to be said or shared or disagreed with too, around there's always something to risk. We like to be comfortable. Are these some of these ideas around safety? What's coming up for you? What are you seeing? What's important here? Amy Jo.
I just want to say that I really enjoyed the way you phrased that around the mystery and the cycles of life, and that trying to ignore that removes us from the beauty of life. And I think that's such a beautiful perspective to hold on to. And I also wanted to add that there was a moment a couple of years ago where I was doing some really deep work and really kind of in a very dark and sort of in the depths of despair kind of moment in my life. And I received a message from whatever inner psyche or ancestor or something that said, Amy Jo, are you here to be comfortable? And I knew in that moment, I was like, no, that's not what this is about. And so that's been something that's really carried me through. And I feel like allowing ourselves to embrace that is really one of the big tests that we get to experience in life.
Yeah, I love how you're putting that. And I agree 100%. There are moments for comfort for sure. And I look for them in the right moments. And then there are moments to move beyond that.
Yeah, and I should add for context is that it was coming to me in a moment where I was avoiding making a very important decision that needed to be made out of the fear of the discomfort. And so, yeah, of course, there's definitely room for comfort as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Beautiful. Something about what Amy Jo just said made me realize I had wanted to say this too. On the topic of discomfort, that also means that as practitioners, it's important for us to get comfortable with our clients' discomfort and not need to cling onto them needing to be comfortable all the time. Linda.
That just hit me in a really deep way, this whole thing about change, how change is happening all the time, and this safety thing that we hold on to. And I think so much, I can see how much I've worked on like this root chakra stuff around feeling safe in the world and needing that, and that's a basic foundational need for people, that it can be like a crutch at a certain point. So there's this balance of knowing that you're safe in the world, but it doesn't mean you don't also embrace change. So this, I don't know, that just is what kind of.
Yes, I love it. I'm so glad that that's coming through for you. I'm so glad that you're bringing it into the conversation. It is so valuable to work on the base chakra and feelings of safety for sure. And when I hear you saying, which I agree with 100%, is for us to hold the both and the nuance and the not using the need for constant safety as a crutch as we move through the world and through our lives. Beautiful. Thank you. Carlita's saying in the chat, just hearing you say the addiction of being safe and secure helps me soften around my own security orientation, that low-grade hum of anxiety. Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that, Carlita, and I'm glad you're bringing that forward. And Hema's saying you can definitely see how culture, society is wired to be risk averse, especially in current times. Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right, let's go a little bit further. So that brings us to our next concept, one that you have probably heard before, which is that there's a great acronym for the word fear, which is false evidence appearing real. False evidence appearing real. What that means is that oftentimes when you go into a place of fear, you're actually looking for, searching for, and maybe even bending some facts to find evidence in any little experience or scenario or email or glance or text to confirm your fear. If you are guilty of this, just raise your hand. I know I am. But most of the time, the evidence isn't actually real. It's false. It's just that we are looking so hard and even bending facts for a confirmation of what we're afraid of. So where is a place that maybe you're doing this right now? In your life, in your work, in your business? Looking for false evidence to appear real and confirm a fear. Ah, Shauna's saying my husband likes the acronym Face Everything and Rise. I love that. All right. So let's pause here for a moment. Anything else that wants to be shared on any of these foundations, on anything that we've looked at so far around fear? Any thoughts coming together? Any ahas? What's moving for you? Anything else that wants to be shared? Libby's saying in the chat, confirmation bias is weighted to see things about ourselves 9 times more negatively than real. Take that in. I want to remember that the next time I'm in that, right? Stacy, do you want to ask your question voice to voice? I'm not sure sometimes I don't totally get it in the chat.
Sure. what I was asking was about, we were talking about, you were saying how anything can happen and people use safety as a crutch. Myself as one. So I'm trying to understand like the process of what's happening with my clients when they're confronted with their fear and they're explaining the problem from this idea of lowering the risk, like that it's a smart thing, that they've covered all their bases, that they've used all of their knowledge and skill and expertise to lower the chance that their project may fail. And so as I'm coaching to help them, I'm struggling here to put this into words, but coaching them to understand that their desire for something is reason enough to take the risk when it's aligned with the energy of what's coming next, what wants to be born through them, no matter the uncertainty. Right? Because these are such uncertain times and people are swirling in fear. It's just walking outside is fearful. So people are overwhelmed. So how to help people step into choosing uncertainty during this time just feels really poignant.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah. Yes. I love that question and I love what you're sharing. And so a couple things. First of all, not to say wait till next week, because I think the process help that we'll learn helps a lot with it. So we'll learn the process. But even before we get there, a couple of things. Number one, first, just to celebrate clients for mitigating risk. That's awesome. That's such a great skill and strategy and something that I, as a coach and practitioner, bring into a conversation sometimes, right? Like, what can we do to mitigate risk here? Totally valuable and helpful and awesome. So that's number one. From there, as you look with your clients at the desire versus the risk, it can be really helpful to create awareness around, for lack of a better way of saying it, how old is the part of them that is scared of the risk? So oftentimes, because of what I was sharing earlier, you know, sometimes fear are like, there is an actual threat to survival. That's why fear is there. It's really like survival mechanism. Sometimes there's an actual threat to survival in front of us. We want to pay. We really want to like listen to the fear in those moments. But most of the time when the fear comes up, it's because of that faulty smoke alarm triggered a fear from the past, from a much younger self. And then that younger self is running the show versus the adult self running the show. So when we can create awareness for our clients and help them discern how their adult self sees the risk versus how their child self or past self, you know, from whenever that survival, the real survival thing came up, it can be so helpful in shifting perspective on risk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. There is just a small piece there I'm a little confused about, and that's the piece with the analogy of the faulty smoke detector. In my mind, I'm always trying to check my filters with, am I saying something that implies there's something that's not working in them? You know, something that needs fixing. And so when I use the analogy, when I'm thinking of using the analogy of the faulty smoke detector and them, see, I'm often looking to help them develop a deeper trust in their knowing, right? So if I use an analogy that they have a faulty smoke detector, that would make them second guess themselves even further, right?
Yeah, I love that you're bringing that up. And, you know, as you're saying that, I'm like, yeah, faulty. I mean, I don't think I would use faulty with a client, and you're right. Like, faulty is so hypersensitive, right? You can be whole and complete and still trust yourself while learning to discern the voice of the voice of the hypersensitive fear versus the voice of the, I don't want to call it like the inner wisdom fear, if you will. Is it helpful to think of it that way?
Yeah. Like hypersensitive as in hypervigilant to getting, re-experiencing that old wound, that old trauma.
Yeah.
Is that really present? Is that, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Libby.
Just jumping on that idea, I like to explain to my clients that their essence is very different and it's, you know, unchangeable as compared to what their neural pathways are that they have wired in their brain. So their neural pathways are going to be dependent on their conditioning and their traumas and their fears and their beliefs. And that, from a position of an essence of whole and complete, they have freedom to evaluate and go into the neural pathways because their identity isn't derived from their neural pathways. It's just their wiring. So their inner voice comes from their essence. But their neural pathways will kick up a fit and make a lot of noise sometimes.
Beautiful. I love that. I love that. And I'll just add to that, you know, sometimes it's helpful to, I have found that the quality of the voice is different.
Yes.
And so, and it's different for each client, right? For each individual, but supporting clients to not only discern what you're talking about, Libby, but also like the quality of that voice to know when which is which can be really helpful.
Yeah. One is very expansive and loving, and another is accusatory or directive or contracting in some way. You can literally feel it.
Yes. All right. I think this is a good place for us to wrap for today. We still have a lot more to come. When we come back together next week, we'll look at the process. What we didn't get to today, you'll get a resource sheet on it, and I'll also swing back to it next week. But in case you see this in the resource sheet and you're like, well, we didn't cover this, is I also just share some of the most common underlying fears. I mean, there's so many, but I think it's good as practitioners to just have in our lexicon different common underlying fears that can come up for clients. And so you'll get a resource sheet on that. All right. So before we wrap for today, I'd love to hear, what are you taking away from our call? What are you taking away? Nahal.
I've never heard that story of the wind and the sun applied to holding space for an emotion before, and it felt really good to see it in that lens. So thank you.
I'm so glad it's helpful. Who else? I'd love to hear one more share before we wrap. What are you taking away?
Trying to quickly type, and it's not quick. So just that someone can have fear and Sounds so crazy. You can just have fear. One can just have fear, and it doesn't actually have to prevent the thing that I'm afraid of. Like it doesn't have to prevent, I guess, is the thing.
Yes. Yes. And actually, it could be a great indicator that you're on the right path, because it is part of the process of growth. I love that. Yeah, that's a great, those are great words to end on. We can have fear. All right. With that, I'm sending everyone a lot of love, and I'm happy to continue to hear your questions and your takeaways and all that comes up. And I can't wait to keep on going deeper next week. Talk to you all soon. Bye.